William James died 100 years ago, but he's had remarkable staying power and is still someone who people often refer to. Why do you think so many people still care about William James?
It's an interesting question. He was ahead of his time. He also had many of the ideas that we call modernity, the idea of the stream of consciousness, the idea that there may be nothing more than a thought that's the thinker. He was a deeply Darwinian early on and committed so. He also had a very unconventional education, and I can't help but think that that's an advantage. John Dewey thought it was a major advantage because it helped him to avoid received ideas and he could look ahead.
Well, we should talk about that for a moment, because he never got a high school diploma or a college degree or a PhD. And yet he got an MD from Harvard Medical School, taught for years at Harvard, and spanned so many different disciplines without any kind of conventional educational background.
That's exactly right. He went to many, many schools as a boy because his father was always moving them around. His father also had a prejudice against college education because it hadn't worked for him, so he wouldn't let either William or Henry James, the novelist, have a college education in a regular sense. He let him go to a scientific school, which was very much a sort of second-class operation at Harvard at the time. And then later, William got a medical degree at a time when a medical degree was not a difficult thing to get and didn't stand for a great deal. But the home was a very lively university all by itself. The father read everything. The boys and their sister talked about all kinds of things. And that unconventional family plus terrific energy of mind makes a great combination. He could look forward, not backward. He didn't have a classical education. He had no connection to the land. His grandparents had no part in the American Revolution. There wasn't much conservative about his education or setting or mind.
So there was something about that family environment that encouraged new ideas. And my sense is that growing up in the James household with the father, Henry Sr., and William's brother, Henry James, the great novelist, I mean, it was all kind of a hothouse, wasn't it?
It really was. And there was a sister who became a great diarist, Alice James. There were two younger brothers, Wilkie and Bob, both of whom fought in the Civil War. So there was really a large family gathering, and they talked and gesticulated. And when the Emersons would go and visit the Jameses, they would remark how people got up in the middle of the floor to carry on arguments, or they would hurl curses at the father, saying they hoped there would always be lumps in his mashed potatoes. It was just a continual circus.
Is William James a kind of public intellectual who has largely disappeared from American life?
He is a public intellectual. He deliberately addressed gatherings of teachers, of generally educated people. He gave public lectures in the Lowell Lecture Series when that was an early public forum for people. He sought out something that was outside academe as a forum. And there are people who do that today. I think they're perhaps less central, and it would be harder to put your finger on many of them. But very quickly, Louis Menand, who writes for The New Yorker, who's written beautifully on James and Peirce, is a public intellectual. He writes in The New Yorker. He can't write a bad sentence. No, I think the genre is still there.
No, it's also striking that William James spanned many different fields. I mean, what we would call today disciplines. I mean, he was a pioneer in psychology and physiology, a leading philosopher, and of course a seminal figure in comparative religion. That kind of breadth of intellectual range is remarkable.
It is remarkable. It's the sort of thing that gets you made into a university professor these days if you get that far. But they were all connected in a way. James really began in physiology. He began teaching the dissection course for undergraduates at Harvard and became very much obsessed with, interested in the physical basis of things. the physical basis of emotion, the physical basis of mind, the physical basis of anything, because he was there taking a body apart with his fingers. And from physiology, he could move to psychology, which is the study of the mind. And his take on psychology was that it was rooted in physiology. So he's in on the beginning of modern psychology that way, in which he's not saying, well, there's mind, there's body. He really saw that there was a continuum between mind and body. And then from psychology, he could go on to philosophy or, and as he was always doing, on to religious matters. In religious matters, he would find that there's no real distinction between spirit and matter, between mind and spirit.
Why did he think there was no distinction between spirit and matter?
No wall separating the two might be a better way to put it. Hmm. That the he once, after a person had lost a child, wrote, to anyone who's ever looked on the face of a dead child or parent, the mere fact that matter could have taken for a time that precious form ought to make matter sacred forever after. It makes no difference. It makes no difference what the principle of life may be, material or immaterial, he writes. Matter at any rate cooperates, lends itself to all life's purposes. That's just a wonderful statement of why it really doesn't finally matter whether life is material or immaterial. The materialism lends itself to all of our purposes.
Hmm. I recently read his classic book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and once I got past some of the language he used, I was struck by how utterly contemporary that book still feels. I mean, it could have been written last year.
Well, people still find that book inspiring or encouraging or helpful. It's a book that people often cite when they reach out and put their hands on the books that have helped them to live. And one of the things about the varieties that you notice when you look at it the sort of second time is that it's almost all in witness form. What James does is to allow person after person after person, 45 people per chapter sort of, to say their piece, to say how it felt for them, how it was for them. And the result of this is this almost fire hose of primary testimony, primary witness, bearing witness to the word and to what it is meant to you. You really can't argue it down because here are all these people saying, this is how it felt to me, this is how it felt to me. And you add all that up and you say, now, what religion is how it feels to each.
Hmm. So what's so striking about James's understanding of religion is that he considered experience to be what's central, I mean, far more than any theological doctrine or belief system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why was this so important to him to look at religion through the prism of various kinds of experiences?
Well, it was the way he looked at everything. He thought that mind was activity. If you go back to John Locke and the old notion that the human being is a tabula rasa, a blank slate that experience writes on, James rejected that as far too passive. He thought the mind was active. It went out and saw things and sought things and wrote and said and spoke and fought. And he had the same notion for religion. It's not going to be the book that you pick up or the church or the mosque or the temple that you go to. It's not going to be the holy man or woman that you listen to. It is going to be your religious experience. This is what is revolutionary about James, and it's still true.
Did he equate religious experiences with mysticism? I mean, was he looking for a particular kind of religious experience?
No, he was looking for all kinds of religious experience, and the varieties lists a great many different kinds of a feeling of a higher power, a feeling of well-being, a feeling of abasement, a feeling of abandonment. There are many, many feelings in there. Mysticism, though, for him remains the sort of blue flower, the best of the best, the final best expression of the religious spirit would be in personal mystical experience. But that by no means exhausts it, because it's all the other things too.
What was his understanding of mystical experience? What the root of that was?
Well, I think he thought, or he certainly hoped, that the mystical experience allowed the individual mind to touch on what we'd have to call a world soul or a world mind, something larger than itself, and that that feeling of oneness and that there's a friendly higher power out there for us in some form. And that feeling comes, is mystically communicated and produces great contentment and wisdom and beatitude.
You haven't used the word God, but that sure is what it sounds like.
It does sound like that. And he would not avoid the word, though I think he would not want to rush into it either and say, well, we start with God. What James is out to show, though, is that if you look at the religious experiences of all these people, each one seems to lead back in that direction.
Well, he called himself a radical empiricist, which I take to mean that experience mattered more to him than any kind of underlying theory about religion. Am I right?
I think that's right, yeah. Radical empiricism is a sort of difficult and late phase of how he formulated it for himself. And it suggests that reality really is experience. The hooker is that all of our experiences have to matter, not just selected experiences for this or that purpose, but that it is all of experience that makes reality.
So how do you think he thought about these things himself? I mean, did he, I don't know if believing in God is the right question, but did he have some feeling of this underlying world soul? Did he have personal mystical experiences himself?
If he did, he is very careful to say he didn't, because he does not want to antagonize the people who were going to jump on him if he claims that immediately. And he also was a very cautious man in one way. He insisted, for example, he went to a lot of seances and got in trouble with all kinds of people for his interest in spiritualism. And the scientists didn't like it that he even considered the possibility of seances and life after death and other things like that. And the spiritualists hated him because he wanted the same kind of empirical proof for their claims that he wanted for oxygen and physical substances. So he had a kind of a no-win situation. But there again, he would say, if you have the experience, then that has to be counted as part of reality.
Nowadays, it's academic suicide to seriously investigate the paranormal. I guess I wonder if the intellectual environment was different back in the late 19th century, or was William James just more willing to stick out his neck?
I think it's probably a little of each. We're another 100 years downstream on paranormal experiences and experiments. And J.B. Rhine at Duke tried and tried and tried and tried and finally just found nothing really convincing that way. So it has become 100 years harder to argue for the paranormal. But it was already difficult in James's day. And I would argue that the same hardening of the arteries that he had to fight has to be fought again today, because you will find public intellectuals who will say there's no possibility that there can be a God. And they're simply so sure of it that there's no possible argument. James's position was that nothing's really settled. And he would ask, what has been concluded in the way of life that we can make little conclusions about it? It's still an ongoing thing. It is too early to say, too early to settle, finally. And he was unwilling to finally settle and say, well, yes, there is a supernatural, or, well, no, there isn't a supernatural. He kept it open in a kind of endlessly heroic way.
Well, what's also striking specifically about his investigation of these psychic experiences, and he wasn't alone in doing this. He had this little band of scientists he investigated with. I mean, they went to seances, they looked at mediums and tried to figure out, you know, who was the real thing and who were the frauds. Most of the ones they encountered seemed to be frauds. But there were a few that who at least William James thought had real psychic powers, most notably a Mrs. Piper.
Mrs. Piper is James's exception. He once called her a white crow, proving that there could be such a thing as a white crow, that there could be such a thing as a medium who was actually in touch with the beyond. And he couldn't prove it, but it was his deepest conviction that she really was in communication with something out there. And they never found Mrs. Piper engaging in any kind of open fraud. And I'm afraid her life is still a kind of open question that way.
What was it that he found so remarkable about what she could do?
She seemed able to read family dynamics in an astonishing way. Who in the James family was feeling badly, or who had died recently, or who had to be buried recently. There is an enormous amount of material on this, sort of buried in the archives of the Society for Psychic Research, and because James wrote down a lot of the seance sessions that he went to. And he was discouraged by almost every single event or every single session. And yet he didn't want to say it was a closed book. I think it's that final little refusal to say, ah, I have it, this is it, permanently, it's sealed. He just wouldn't do it. Hmm. He really found it harder and harder to believe. And one time he was up in Maine at a seance that was organized by a man named Dorr, who was the founder of Acadia National Park up there. And James went up in the winter to watch this small circle of mediums work around a brass rail. And he said he saw the brass rail move all by itself. It was daylight. He could see. There was no problem with it. It very clearly moved, and it should have shaken his entire universe. And he said he just couldn't find himself believing it. It's a really fascinating little moment. Even when presented with what looked like the visual evidence, he wouldn't quite say this was it. Hmm. So well, it's that always holding back a little bit that's so wonderful.
Well, there's a paradox, it seems to me, at the center of James's thinking, particularly about the mind and about these kinds of transcendent realities. And that's, on the one hand, he really thought that the mind was pretty much determined by brain function. He didn't think the mind was something separate from what the brain does. And yet, on the other hand, mm-hmm. he seemed to be totally open to the possibility that the mind could communicate with other minds or other dimensions, which seems to be contradictory.
It does. That's very well put. You're a good reader. What James thought might be true, and he says it in a suggestion concerning mysticism, which is a late piece he put together, was that there might be a threshold in the mind where the individual mind touches a larger mind. It's a sort of Jungian idea. And it's a fair bet that Jung actually took this from William James, whom he read and admired on that. And that the experience that allows you to cross that threshold from your mind to the larger mind of the world is something that James thought might be there, though, again, he was never willing to say in a dogmatic way that it had to be there. But that's how he would resolve that little contradiction, is that there's a possibility that our individual minds can touch in the way that Emerson sort of earlier suggested, that larger mind, that oversoul.
What I find so attractive about William James is that he is a visionary, in the sense that he thought the world was open to all kinds of possibilities. He wanted to explore all these different sort of dimensions of reality. And yet he was also very comfortable living with uncertainty and ambiguity and the prospect that we would never know anything for certain. I mean, those are kind of two qualities that rarely go together, I think.
It is, and I keep joining the things that you are very carefully distinguishing. But I think you are exactly right on that one. And one of the hallmarks of James's mind is this ability to hold conflicting points of view in his own mind, I think. And he can feel several ways about something. And he doesn't try to slick it up into a unified system for us. He's willing to let it sit out there. And it is one of the deeply attractive things about him. He does seem open to this kind of contrariety.
Now, he had a number of personal struggles himself, didn't he? I mean, for one thing, he said that he had to struggle with melancholy throughout his whole life.
That is true. It was worst, I think, in the teenage years or the early 20s when he didn't know really what he was going to do for a profession, and he didn't know. And the person that he loved most, Minnie Temple, died on him. And
he had some sort of terrifying experience shortly after she died.
And he had a terrifying experience, very reminiscent of an experience his father had had after Minnie died, that he was alone in an asylum with a green-skinned idiot. And suddenly James saw that figure he was looking at was potentially him, and that there was just about nothing separating him from the sort of chattering abyss of insanity. And he pulled back from that, he said, and was not the same for months after that.
When you say he had a vision, this wasn't a dream. This was some sort of a vision in a waking state?
This was some sort of vision in waking state, apparently. The only way we know it is that the account of it is in the Varieties of Religious Experience, and it's attributed there to a Frenchman. But it's not a Frenchman. It's James's own. And it isn't sure how much earlier he wrote it down, though he probably had to have written it down right after it happened. But he didn't want to put his own name on it.
Didn't he used to keep a journal? And those particular pages that, you know, would have been the time when this happened, he ripped out of his journal?
Yeah. Yeah, they're gone. And you can come across that journal. It's among his papers at Harvard. And there are all kinds of places where the pages are ripped out, and not just there, but elsewhere. And one really does wonder. He did have some tough times.
You're painting a portrait of a man who had some very profound experience of existential angst. I mean, this is to some degree what his life work was all about, trying to deal with that.
Trying to make sense of that. He came out of it. He came out of it at about age 28 or so. And a combination of things. He got a full-time teaching appointment at Harvard, and he rather liked it. And he fell in love with and married a wonderful woman named Alice Gibbons, and she was marvelous for him. And things straightened out after that, and he got a proposal from Henry Holt to write a psychology book, and suddenly everything was going in the right direction. And it's hard to say whether it was work or marriage or publication or what, but all those three came together, and he never again afterwards had the same sort of prolonged melancholy.
Hmm. Now, he is known, among other things, for his work on the study of consciousness. In fact, was he the one who coined the phrase stream of consciousness?
I don't believe it's his phrase, but he does use it all the time. The phrase can be found elsewhere in the 1890s. But he is certainly the one who took it up and whose use of it is the use that's always cited. And it's the notion that there really isn't a thing called the mind, a block or a cube or a machine. What there is a process of perceptions. And one perception follows another. And that's about as close as we get to being able to say what consciousness is. It is a stream of impressions. It's never the same twice.
Hmm. Of course, the study of consciousness is still enormously controversial to this day, or what we understand about consciousness. Do you think his ideas still hold up?
Well, I think he found the question. And he and his brother, Henry, the novelist, who writes novels of consciousness. If you look at it that way, here is William doing the psychological, philosophical, and religious side of consciousness, and Henry doing the novelistic and the social side. The two brothers together, I think, can fairly be said to have put consciousness at the center of the American agenda.
What was the nature of their relationship, the two brothers?
Well, it was a long and fascinating one. When they were young, they were competitive. William was older. William was about a year and 3 months older. But seemed much older in some ways. Henry is always complaining about every, as soon as he goes into a room, William is out of the room. He just can never catch up with him. And they competed about things, but gradually Henry became the mother's favorite and a kind of indoor boy and somebody who read everything and read all the time. And William was his father's favorite, and he spent much more time outside and running around and active, so that there were differences. But they were always competitive at home and competitive around the table. And this has been exaggerated over the years in biographies. And what they've sort of left out or forgotten is that as they went along, William would write these scathing comments on Henry's novels and say, couldn't he just spit it out for once? Stop beating around the bush. You know, this endless circumlocution.
A sentiment and that is still widely shared among readers today.
And Henry would write back to William and say, you know, he really didn't understand anything about fiction and should keep quiet about it. So that there was all kinds of hostility and comic hostility. And then at the end, as they both got sick, they got so close together. William was lying, dying in Massachusetts, and a telegram arrived that Henry had had a stroke and was dying. And William, although he was declining toward the end, and this is the last year of his life, he jumped on a boat with his wife and they raced to England in order to be with Henry. And Alice nursed Henry and William side by side. Henry couldn't talk and William couldn't walk, she said. And she took them both to the continent and they tried spas and they tried all kinds of health regimes. Nothing worked. They came back to this country. They came back to Quebec. They then came down by train to Chicago in New Hampshire, which is where William had his summer home, because he wanted to see it one last time. And he saw it with his brother. He's coming down with his brother on the train from Quebec. And Henry looks out the window and says, God, what a godforsaken wilderness. And the dying William James rises up and he says, better than anything in England, Henry, better than anything in Europe. And so to Chikarawa, and William dies, and the last thing, one of the last things he says is to commend his wife to Henry and Henry to his wife when Henry's time came. And this life of competition and sort of Jacob and Esau ends with this astonishing, wonderful, warm reconciliation of brothers and leaning on each other and each other's best friend. It's a very moving story, and that one's never really been told.
It sounds like also, despite all of their competitiveness throughout their lives, especially when they were younger, they kept influencing each other. William clearly read Henry's novels, and I'm guessing that William's ideas about consciousness and the mind and all of that influenced the way Henry wrote.
Oh, it's clear. And Henry would send a note to William saying, congratulations on pragmatism. I discovered I've always pragmatized. And he was pleased to enroll himself as a member of William's Philosophical Club.
Let's talk some about the influence of William James over the years. I suppose perhaps the most famous acolyte was Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, who credited William James's ideas with some of the core principles of AA, right?
That's right. Bill Wilson called James the unacknowledged founder, an unacknowledged founder of AA, because it was from reading the six soul chapters of the varieties that Wilson got the idea, as he explained it in a letter, of trying to make William James's notions of conversion available on a wholesale basis, meaning to anybody who wanted. And Wilson could see that conversion was not to be considered just a Christian matter or just an Islamic matter or just Jewish. Conversion was a psychological thing that took place. And it could take place and turn a person into a miser, or it might take place and turn an alcoholic into a sober person. The thing to reach for was that process of conversion.
What did he mean by conversion?
Conversion is this moment in which the way you have been will no longer do, and you reach for a new way, and you convert your life into something different. The moment, for example, in AA comes when you admit your helplessness and your hopelessness, and you admit that you are no longer in charge of your own life and that something else has to happen. And then comes the possibility of conversion to sobriety.
So to some degree, you are surrendering to a higher power.
You absolutely. The self-surrender is crucial. And every religious tradition, going back into Sufism and Christian mysticism, all insist on this, that you have to arrive at the helplessness of the individual.
And was that one of William James's insights about religion?
It is, and it's in the six whole chapters of the varieties, and it's in his own life, that thing we spoke of a moment ago when the vision of the green-skinned idiot in the asylum produced in him this feeling of momentary complete helplessness, that he was powerless to prevent himself from becoming that figure. And that admission of powerlessness, in some way, I don't understand. But I've been told again and again and again, that's the gate.
What do you mean you don't understand it?
I mean, I haven't walked through it, so I don't know. I would not claim for myself a rebirth of that sort or a conversion of that sort.
Why are you so interested in William James? I mean, you wrote your biography some years back. You've now edited a collection of his essays. Why do you keep coming back to him?
Well, he's one of the people that whose books I pick up when I need help, when I need to be cheered up about the world or about the place of the individual in American life or my own life. I find reading Thoreau, Emerson, and perhaps above all, William James, the way out for me, or a way forward. I mean, he has a wonderful argument on the moral equivalent of war. He has perhaps the central piece of his work, in his own view, is an essay called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, in which he talks about our absolute inability to understand the motives of people unlike ourselves. I think that's so deeply needed today and so relevant to my own life as I look around me all the time that I don't know where better to find a more lively, more sympathetic mind.
Now, you have written biographies of Thoreau, Emerson, and William James. Do they share something in common?
Well, I think what they share is a belief that whenever we finally find out what it is that runs the universe, it's going to be found to be something commensurate with human powers, not beyond them and not confounding to them, that somehow the human mind and the human experience is going to be adequate to this brave new world that we're finding. I think it's that belief in the final adequacy of the human being. It's a deeply anti-Puritan point of view. Instead of saying, oh, we are fallen and hopeless and it's over and gone and we can't do it, all these three and others besides keep saying, no, we can finally fundamentally do it.
Do you think that's a particularly American insight?
I don't think it has to be. I mean, I find that the writers we've just mentioned are all Americans. But there's nothing national in that thought, it seems to me. The what Haiti needs now is for many, many people in Haiti to find the adequacy within themselves to do what has to be done in Haiti. I think it's widely available for export.
I want to talk for a moment about the reputation that William James has today, because as we mentioned before, he is widely cited by many people. Many people still consider him a very influential figure. And yet, when I have talked with philosophers in academic departments, they don't always think that highly of him, at least based on this small sample of my questions. He seems to be a little confused, or it's not clearly spelled out. And my sense is that maybe among professional philosophers, he's actually kind of seen better days. Do you think that's true?
Well, it is true. He has seen better days among a wide spectrum of professional philosophy. He's also in a bit of a revival at the moment, because pragmatism is sort of coming back. And there are quite a few new books and courses and conferences spinning around the new pragmatism. There are philosophers like John McDermott who have always stood up for James and done it beautifully and brilliantly. But there is also in professional philosophy a kind of permanent strain of, I would call it, Platonic sleep. There's the notion that there are such things as pure ideas, and that's what we have to live by, not actualisms, that the phenomenal world is not real. The only thing that's real are the final ideas from which all things come. James just didn't see that. And James's life and his work is this sort of constant argument against Plato. He just hasn't quite won it yet in all of the referees' minds, but that's still possible. Psychology, on the other hand, has been very much more open to James recently than philosophy in many ways. And in religious studies, there are schools where they talk about the gospel according to James, and they don't mean the King James Bible. They're still talking about the varieties of religious experience and the powerful grounding that gives to individual experience. So I think James may have his best days still ahead.
What do you think William James would make of the way religion is talked about in our own culture today, and particularly the debate between religious believers and the so-called new atheists?
I imagine he'd have found a ground in which he could accept both points of view, and then he would try to lay it out for us so that we could see which way the likelihood lay. I think he'd be very skeptical of people who say, and I've read several books like this in the last 10 years, there is no possibility that there's a soul. There's no possibility that there's life after death. There is no possibility that there is God. James just didn't think we'd gotten to the point where we were allowed to make these huge, permanent, absolute claims. And he, from his point of view, a rigid belief that there is no God is not to be distinguished from the rigid belief that God controls everything. They're both rigid beliefs, is the thing about them. The only real difference would be found in somebody who was a skeptic, somebody who wasn't sure, somebody who asked questions. And you have to retreat from rhetorical heat and the public battle in order to say, well, I wonder. And that's the person with the open mind. That's the person who has something opposed to either a sure belief that there's a God or a sure belief that there isn't.
Of course, what has happened since William James's own day is science has marched on in many fields, neuroscience, and now there are a lot of brain scientists who think that religion can be more or less explained by the studying how the brain works. And on the cosmological front, well, we've just heard Stephen Hawking say that our understanding of the laws of the universe means that we don't need God there anymore. What would James make of sort of these scientific claims to displace religion?
Well, it's hard to say because he didn't have a fixed sort of playbook from which he would read on these things. And I can find it easy to say that he would entertain both positions. And I'm sure he would. He also left enough hints in his notebooks and elsewhere to suggest that he really did believe that there was a God, that there is a religious view of life. And while he couldn't prove it, he certainly wasn't going to push it down anybody's throat. But that was the way his inclination lay. At the same time, that little thing we talked about a minute ago about moving, seeing the brass rail move up in Maine at a little seance suggests that he was also perfectly capable of denying the experience in front of him for something, some other belief that he held. I think he would have come back and said that whether religion depends on God or cosmology, that's not important. What is important now and has always been and will always be is the religious experience of the individual. Now, whether that requires God or simply a higher power or an acknowledgement that something in the world is larger than you are, it's that personal religious experience that I think is not going to go away.
Well, this is all very fascinating. Thank you so much for talking about this.
Well, thank you for having me.